I did a homeless shelter in the South Bay, and which was it was amazing. We had everybody in the entire city like violently against us, and the city council. There's a state law that you can't not build affordable housing that meets the same criteria as market rate. And every single city council member in our final appeal, after all these, we had all these televised hearings, said, oh, I hate this project, it's disgusting, I hate homeless people. But, you know, the city attorney has told me that we're gonna be on the hook for $10 million because of this state law, and then they passed it and got built. So, you know, that's what it takes. Never would have happened.
From Alan, you had mentioned employers. There's been a huge amount of jobs created in the Bay Area over the past couple of years, and not nearly enough housing to go along with it. So, is there a part for employers to build a lot of housing at scale?
You know, I'm always concerned about company housing. It's almost like when you talk to teachers about teacher housing. And you talk to teachers about teacher housing, and if only teachers are living in that housing, they don't want to live there. The College of San Mateo solved that problem by having teachers and staff live there. Teachers and classified staff and janitors and everyone else live in that housing. I'd rather see, in company housing, I'd hate to see a limitation for people that work for that company. But I'd like to see a system that they build housing and make mm-hmm. housing available for workforce, where a blend of workforce within that area could live there, because it doesn't make it like company housing. Mm-hmm. And company housing would mean, you know, just that's it, it's company housing. Mm-hmm. And it has a bad connotation. As for some people that see all the transportation and transit, they think it's good. I think it might have a social issue, and I think the social issue can be met by companies coming together and putting these housing projects together to create a separate housing agency mm-hmm. that would do that with a private housing agency. I think it makes a lot more sense.
Kate, in San Francisco here, with Twitter and other tech companies, have there been conversations about them helping in some way to ease the housing crisis?
There have been conversations, but frankly, they haven't gone very far. I mean, there's not a feeling of responsibility that we're seeing play out in terms of the provision of housing for the workforce. I mean, and that's not to say that there aren't generous philanthropists within the community. The business community who are doing great things. I mean, certainly Mark Benioff has done great stuff around homeless family housing in San Francisco, but we're not seeing that play out in a meaningful way.
With in lieu fees of $330,000 per unit and 25% affordable for new market rate projects, what do you guys think of that as an added cost to a project?
Well, but you have a cap rate, and if you charge a $300,000 fee, then that market rate developer has to charge $2,500 of rent to cover that fee, something like that?
You're making the level of housing go up much too high, the cost of housing, and what you're doing is you're taxing the other individuals indirectly who have to live in that housing for the other people living there. It's a way the politicians don't have to say we're passing a new tax, take care of our housing needs. The other thing is when you do that inclusionary housing, you can't bring in the really good below market rate housing people like a bridge housing. You can't bring them in to that if there's an apartment here and an apartment there and an apartment here. It's below market rate housing. They can't take advantage of the federal tax credits or what little dollars are available that way, because you're pulling it out of the general, you're going against the general market, and you're not letting it be as inexpensive as it could be with the tax benefits.
And I would argue that inclusionary housing is a good thing. It's maybe not the best thing. I would like to attach housing more to commercial development. It's really the driver of our housing problem. rather than taxing or putting the burden on housing. But that said, you can do inclusionary housing even at high percentages, and we've seen some of the big projects in town here doing it, if you also give some density bonus or other, you know, you give something to get something. Basically, you create more value in the development by adding units to it, and then some of that is extracted and becomes public benefit in the form of affordable housing. For a city project got to 40% by doing that, by being able to build a lot more, and it was both more affordable and more market rate came out of it.
But if you have too many jobs and you have a tax that's going to slow down, if the problem is too many jobs, a tax on jobs would slow that down and help things. Don't have enough housing, a tax on housing slows that down and hurts things. And that's the really simplistic thing. I realize people benefit from it, and there's small benefits, but overall, it's doing the wrong thing. But we like it because it's the only game in town.
Ideally, we don't have to tax or burden anything with that, and we have other streams of revenue to build affordable housing, but we're in a world that's very constrained, and we're trying to do everything we can.
Yeah, that brings up another issue that's the same as benefits-based coding, and that's what you were talking about. And benefits-based coding was used in Arlington, Virginia, and the community allowed height in the transit-oriented development areas. And basically, in using that height, they created $1.5 billion of public benefits. And you can take that and use those public benefits how you use them, but what you're saying to someone is you can only build 55 feet here. If you want to build 70 feet and you give us a much higher percentage of below market rate housing or provide money into a fund to do that, we're going to let you do it if it works within the community. That's a way to do it, and instead of just regulating it, using the marketplace to make it work. And the marketplace, at the end of the day, is the most effective tool to make it work.
Kate, with the in-lieu fees that are collected by the city, how do you prioritize where the money goes?
Well, first of all, I do want to say that the inclusionary housing rules that we have are really critical to keeping a mixed-income community and to funding our affordable developments. I mean, I do agree that it's not the best way because it puts the whole burden of providing affordable housing on the developers, and it does make housing more expensive overall. I mean, we have a much better, it would be much better to use a broad tax base to fund affordable housing through rental subsidies, through, you know, the diversion of the mortgage interest tax deduction, as I was talking about. But anyway, so there are flaws, but we do have really significant housing produced through these fees, and we're very constrained on what we can do. It has to be new construction, and it can't exceed 120% of AMI. And because we don't have other financing vehicles, we use those inclusionary fees with tax credits, leveraging tax credits to build affordable housing up to 60% of area median income. So it's great. And our housing production is fantastic at that range, but 61% AMI to 150% AMI, that, you know, all those families that have an affordability gap, they're left out. So, you know, it's a really kind of flawed system, but as David suggested, you know, it's what we have, and we will, you know, continue to build affordable housing with those fees and have on-site inclusionary to try to maintain as much income diversity as we can.
Yes.
The key is, though, and Kate just said it, there's a pass-through, and the pass-through is to the developers, but it isn't the developers who are paying that. It's the people who are buying the houses. And what it is, instead of a broad-based tax, basically what we're doing is we're taxing the other people that need homes. And it does have an effect of reducing the amount of homes available for the workforce that might be able to buy a home, but they're priced out of the market because you have to take the prices up to pay it. So if you have a 25% or a 10% BMR rate in your unit, it's coming out of the other guys. It's not coming out of the developer or the bank or anyone else. It's coming out of the community. it's still coming out of the community. It's just a small group into the community. And mainly, it's the new people in the community that are paying the price.
Yeah, what's interesting is we did a market rate development that has 90 units affordable at 50% of median income. It's great, providing all this great housing. All, you know, huge line, 10-to-1 sign up. But then we figured out that we got on the internet and Craigslist, and there's now startups that break up, you know, the two bedrooms we provide for families, they break those up after market and rent them by the room, including the living room. And they take the $4,000 a month two bedroom and they make it $1,300 a month, basically SRO units. It's incredibly common. So there is, if you are a recent graduate who's moving here to work at Twitter, you can rent a great apartment with this great gym and all this stuff for $1,300, get your own room. And so it's interesting, it's kind of like life will prevail. So it's, you know, it's like the policies get short-circuited by, you know, clever people, and people are all pretty clever.
That sounds like the free market to me.
So we've talked about policy at the city level and at the state level. What needs to happen at the regional level to think about this housing crisis together and how to build housing and pay for housing? Crickets. I hear crickets.
Tax those second homes. Oh.
Tax the second homes?
That'll happen soon.
Well, that's actually on the table now as a source for affordable housing. Eliminating the mortgage interest deduction at the state level for vacation homes. Being considered right now as a source for affordable housing in Sacramento is eliminating the mortgage interest deduction on second homes or vacation homes. I don't know if that'll go anywhere, but that's potentially $300 million, according to the bill's author, annually.
Great. Okay, let's open up to questions in the audience. Jennifer.
I work on the Naval Air Station in Alameda. We're working on our final precise plan for the area. And the number one issue in the Planning Board and City Council is putting work policies and incentivize workforce housing into the actual planning document. And so we've struggled, looked around, and there aren't a lot of examples of how to do that, how to, as David Baker said, encourage it. What are some ideas of specific policies that might actually go into a specific plan to actually encourage workforce housing? We've got the affordable housing requirements covered. More, you know, we have a 25% inclusionary requirement. It's really how do we get at that workforce housing income slot and do it in a way that doesn't actually de-incentivize the production of housing or feasible housing production. So just curious if you guys have any ideas of actual policies that we might put into a planning document to encourage workforce housing.
Well, let's talk about benefits-based zoning, that if you're going to use workforce housing, and of course you have to define workforce because no one has, and if you're the first one, let me know what it is so I know. Okay. Once you define workforce housing, you say if you're going to do this as workforce housing, you can put another floor on, you could use form-based coding. In other words, you can have more density, you can reduce your parking a bit, because if it's local workforce, and any workforce housing would be defined to the local workforce, which means they wouldn't need as many cars, is create that system of benefits and have developers look at that system of benefits and say, could you afford to build? What developers do is, if they're loved, if they're wanted, and if they can finance a project, even if the project doesn't make sense, they're going to do it because it's what they do. They love to build. You know, they're guys with shovels and tools and everything else. They love to build buildings. So if you encourage them this way and make it possible for them to cross that line in the profitability and that they could get their debt and the banks are going to give them the debt, you're going to be able to do it. And if you provide the zoning to be able to do that, you can get there, and basically it comes down to height and density, and you want to make sure there's livability there. You don't want to build a bunch of SROs, but what you want is, or you might, because SROs aren't bad really, but you want to make sure they're building a quality product, and put rules on them that allow them to do it more, give them more for what they're building and what they're giving you. Because on that basis, it could become profitable for them.
Next question.
Well, I'm going to first make a brief comment, and that is the idea that these requirements, for example, inclusionary housing requirements, are automatically passed on to the renters and the buyers. I recommend everybody in this room to look at a paper that I produced with another academic, Nico Calavita, that was funded by MTC, and it's called Public Benefits Zoning, and it asks the very one question it asks is, why would these developers now raise the rents and raise the sales prices because of these public requirements beyond what the market would already bear anyway? So the assumption, which I don't agree with what the people here have said, is that developers are already going to be charging the highest, and that where the cost of providing these benefits should be taken out is in the cost of land. Okay, so I encourage you to read it. Then my quick question is, I have a whole lot of questions. I'm not going to take up time here. Are you available through email to be answering some questions? For example, Alan, I was really impressed by what you said, and I would love to see a pro forma and see how it is different than what I normally see for affordable housing. Thank you.
All right.
Well, there you go.
The question for you, Kate, is why cities see this as housing affordable and tech versus this and newcomer versus old? Why don't we take housing as a housing for everyone? Why don't we have this approach? Because the reason I'm saying it's a very important approach, because once you think this way, that we need housing for all different income groups, then you are not pushing pressure on certain type of groups. So what's happening in a lot of neighborhoods, you cannot really do anything in those neighborhoods. So then those neighborhoods are pushing development in other neighborhoods. I come across so many young people in my neighborhood who cannot afford to live there, even if they want to spend $1 million. And I don't think anybody should be spending $1 million in buying homes in the city. So because there's so many development restrictions in the neighborhood, they are now pushed to another neighborhood. And now those neighborhood then will push people to another neighborhood. Until and unless we take that everybody needs housing, and we need to look at all kind of housing types so that we don't put pressure on the people who are most vulnerable. And then we have to come up with all this creative solution, what to do with it, and then we try to solve a problem by creating more problems.
Be on this side.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Cohen. I'm an architect with TCA Architects. We do large-scale multifamily projects in the hundreds of units, and I'm always amazed, and this goes to the notion of prefab as a way to reduce construction costs. The model that everyone seems to have is the box that fits on a truck that has to be brought from Idaho or Utah, wherever it was, to San Francisco. Why can't we, and I say this because in a typical project of ours, there may be 12, and out of 200 units, there may be 12 unit types. And among those unit types, there may be three or four different kinds of kitchens and five or six different kinds of bathrooms. Why do we make those, why can't we prefab those and just drop them in as appliances with one electrical connection, one plumbing connection? This is done all over the world, by the way, and you can fit a whole bunch of those on a truck, and you just treat them as appliances, and then you can design to site constraints. You can be as creative as you want with facades, and yet, you know, you're just, and if anyone is interested in investing in this idea, I'll give me your card. I really think that I don't know why the rest of the world does that and we don't. Anyone have any ideas about that?
All right. David. Yeah, construction industry is a sticky industry. There actually are people fabricating bathrooms like that to use in type 1 construction, but that's for almost of their market is hotels. And it just hasn't gone to the housing industry. There's a lot of cost to having different variations. And we we're investigating using it. It's too expensive in affordable housing right now. So it just takes a while for these things to work their way through. None of the stuff happens overnight. But it is happening. I would say that. So I think it's really a both and thing. It's kind of like arguing which is better, BRT or heavy rail, and you go, yeah, they're both better, depending on the situation.
I mean, you go to a job site and you see, tower setters stepping over, stepping
over. Yeah. Yeah, it's like that tomb, it's like we're cutting, it's crazy. I agree.
Hi, I'm just loving this slide. It's my career is the first to get reviewed on this stuff annually. What'd you do this one? Anyway, I want to go back to the title of this conversation around advancing PDA implementation, because we've watched a lot of station area plans get done around the region. And, the theory is, the idea is that the station area plans get done, and then there's been enough community consensus that smoothly from there forward, as pieces get put in place, they're actualizing the plan. But actually, what happens more typically is that as soon as the first piece gets put in place, another cast of characters come out and are really upset. And didn't know anything about the stationary plan. And so I'm just wondering if there's something that can be done front-loaded with those exercises to remove some of the NIMBYism and barriers going forward. Is there something that MTC could require in those plans, or that the cities could do to, truth test the practicality of things, or something to accelerate the next steps?
The programmatic EIR is probably one of the best ways to come out with a stationary plan, because now you have something that can't easily be beat up because it's been programmed already. You'll still have people against it sometimes, but you'll have a lot less, and they'll have a lot less legal edge to stand on. But you have to get community support to get that stationary plan or the corridor plan. And when you get a corridor plan and it's going well and it's done intelligently, you can push back on that pretty well if you already have it in the general plan and it's already passed as an ordinance. And in San Mateo, the station area plan, they worked on it for 8 years, but it became an ordinance. Once it became an ordinance, it became law. So it's very difficult to turn it down as long as you're within the parameters. And part of being in those parameters and part of delivering a product that'll work like that is having the EIR codified by the city up front, so it's beyond the appeal period. So the EIR is already beyond the appeal period when you're building. And that deals with some of the issues. Not all of the issues, but some of the issues. Because you're also doing a general plan for that area as an area plan, and it's being approved that way by the community up front.
Hey, one more question.
Oh, yeah, one more.
I was just going to jump in on that, and I think I don't know what the techniques are to make the system actually work the way it's supposed to, but it needs to happen. And one of those two projects that Bridge had to walk away from was in a PDA, the only PDA within miles of this site. Planned, part of the RENA analysis, affordable housing goes here. We couldn't get it done. And I've heard repeatedly from community members the interesting, and actually even from a city council person, believe it or not, building within a plan that had taken, 6-8 years to get through the approval process. There's an area plan, everybody agreed on what it's going to be. Projects start coming in that conform to the plan, and the response is, well, it's happening too fast. We need to re-examine. We need to stop. Like, wait a minute. You spent 6 or 8 years approving a plan. Now we're doing what you said we were going to do, but now that's for some reason we need to stop and reevaluate. It's crazy.
Yeah, I think that cities are like people, and there's really functional, wonderful people, and then there's not nice people. And so, like where your family, Andrew, I'll say, is like a really hard place to do. The station area plan was incredibly controversial. And they fought it tooth and nail. In Union City, they're just kind of, oh, this is a great plan, let's go do it. They're just, they're like nice. So, and why? What's the difference between San Leandro and Union City?
Oh,
I don't
nice
know.
Nice in San Mateo, too.
It's like, what? It's just culture. It's like local culture.
It's culture, and I'll without picking on anybody local here. Bridge started working in Portland a couple of years ago, and Portland just does it better. It's much
nice.
More rational.
They're much nicer.
They're nicer people than us, I think. But there, you know, I started doing schedules for projects that we had in our pipeline in Portland, and the local people we hired up there kept coming back and saying, what's all this time in your schedule for entitlements? The site has zoning. We go, what
does
the plan says? And we can do that here, I think, but we're not.
Well, we are down to the last couple of minutes, so sorry, we don't have any time for more questions, but I did want to thank our panel and you, the audience, for coming here. I did have a few concluding remarks relevant to the conversation that we've had today. I think we've had a lot of great discussion and ideas coming forth from the panel, and the question that was raised about what can the regional agencies do, and that's kind of where I'm landing on with my slide here. We do have an ongoing program we call the PDA Planning Program. It's been around for 10 years, and it actually does what the panel has suggested we need more of, which is funding specific plans with programmatic EIRs. And like I say, we have over about 55 projects that have funded over the last 10 years. But for all of you cities out there, we are going to be having a call for projects this year, probably in the spring, to do just that. And if you just, maybe you need to update your EIR or your zoning, but this is an opportunity for you to be able to do that. So stay tuned. And then the other thing, I mean, I know that we've talked about, you know, Kate and, well, everybody has said, well, this is great, but we're going to need more. This is great, but we're going to need more. I mean, all the little things that we have to try to fix this big problem are just not enough. So one of the things that the regional agencies are going to do is establish a new committee, the Committee for Affordable and Sustainable Accommodations, with a acronym CASA. Which we intend to staff this committee. It's not really an MTC or ABAG committee, but it's a regional committee made up of multi-sector participants to try to come up with, I heard game-changing a number of times today, game-changing solutions, which is probably going to mean something in Sacramento or something on the ballot measure or something that is really going to try to get us to closing that gap that we need to be able to build more affordable and workforce housing in the region. So that is going to be starting up within the next month or so, and we're going to really try to identify both near-term and medium-term solutions, and we're just going to try to get that underway. So stay tuned. Hopefully we will come up with some game-changing solutions. So with that, I'd like again to thank our panel and moderator. Give them a hand, please. And thank you all for coming. We will have another Planning Innovations. Make sure you signed in so that we have your email so you can be on the emailing list for our next forum, which will probably be sometime this spring. So thank you again.
Thanks a lot. Boy, speaking,
thank you.
I don't like to hear about inclusionary being a good policy. Hey, too many fans.